Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, the programme that brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. You're welcome to get involved with the programme through Twitter at Inside Ed, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie and through the website insideed.com. If you have an education event or a topic that is of interest, please let me know and I may be able to cover it on a future programme. Early childhood education is the theme of this week's programme, to coincide with a conference that was organised earlier this week in Dublin Castle by the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, the NCCA. The theme of the conference was Early Mathematics is Surprisingly Important and Cognitively Fundamental. The importance of early mathematics is acknowledged in Ireland's relatively new early childhood curriculum framework for children from birth to 6 years, called AISTR. The name AISTR comes from the Irish word for journey, because learning in the early years marks the beginning of children's lifelong learning journeys. One of the keynote speakers at the NCCA conference was Professor Elizabeth Wood from the University of Sheffield. Elizabeth Wood teaches and researches the areas of early childhood and primary education, and she's particularly interested in play and learning and the analysis of practice. When I spoke to Elizabeth Wood, I wanted to find out how much she knew about the early years education system in Ireland. She explained that she has been working with the NCCA since 2010 on the development of AISTR.
Over the last 4 years, AISTR has been developed. There have been some pilot schools working with it. There's been a lot of work and a lot of thought gone into developing AISTR from a ground-up perspective, as well as from a national policy perspective. So I've been very pleased to come back to Dublin to work with the NCCA team and to build on some of the ideas that we've been talking about over the last 4 years.
And what is it about AISTR that interests and excites you about its potential for change in Irish schools?
I like the way that AISTR is being developed quite gradually, and the way that ideas are being put into practice. Practitioners are working with those ideas, giving feedback to the NCCA team. AISTR places play at the heart of the curriculum, but it also has a very clearly articulated understanding of children as confident and competent learners and as practitioners needing the knowledge, the skills and the expertise to be able to support that competence and confidence.
So in terms of how it might impact on practice, what would you like to see happening in early childhood settings and in schools?
I think that AISTR can potentially do two things. On the one hand, it gives practitioners a national framework, but it's quite a flexible framework within which conversations about children, about learning, about pedagogy, about curriculum can develop over time. So practitioners can be talking to each other. So we've got this nice combination of a structured but flexible framework, but the flexibility comes when practitioners can use AISTR in collaboration with their existing approaches. So, for example, there are Montessori schools in Ireland, there are practitioners using the high scope approach. Many practitioners have been inspired by the Reggio Emilia approach from Northern Italy. So it's that nice combination of structure and flexibility. It's not a straitjacket.
And do you think that's a strength of the system, that there is this eclectic approach?
I think that flexibility or that eclecticism is important because for many practitioners, their practice and their provision has evolved over time and often in response to local communities. So they are best placed to understand the cultures and the context within their local communities. But then there comes that maybe that edge of tension between being faithful within the flexibility of AISTR, but doing something that is entirely or potentially at odds with the AISTR framework. So I think there is perhaps the work to be done is around understanding the flexible structures and the scope for local responsiveness. I think parents often make choices based on their existing knowledge and their own beliefs about early childhood education. The power of peer recommendation is extremely important when parents are making choices in their local communities. but they also need practitioners to communicate clearly with them what their setting is about, what they can see when they bring their children to the setting, and more importantly, the quality of experiences that those children will have in the setting and how those experiences will support their child's learning and development.
So if we take the example of play, which is an area that you're obviously very interested in, is it just a matter of letting children play?
Well, it would be nice, wouldn't it, Sean, if it was that simple. There is so much research from all over the world that tells us that play is fundamentally important for children's learning and development. But it isn't just the play itself. It's actually what children are doing in their playful and freely chosen activities. So, for example, they are engaging with their peers. They're playing alongside children of their own age, sometimes children a little bit older or younger. They are engaging with all sorts of different materials. It might be building bricks, sand, water. They might have access to a lovely outdoor environment where they can dig and plant things and grow things and go up and down climbing frames and run around and have races. So it's actually what happens within the play that drives children's learning and development. So that leads to the question of, are there forms of play that are particularly important for young children? And in answer to that question, I think children, and again the research shows us, that children benefit from freely chosen activities, that is the activities that they themselves choose, that might be individually, it might be with a friend, or it might be with a group of friends. So they have their freely chosen activities, but also a mix of some structured activities also can provoke challenge and extension and development. So children do enjoy playing alongside adults. They like to play quite structured games. So, for example, matching games, board games that involve counting and competition. So they like to be able to choose to be with playful adults who can provide some structure, but they also like that freedom to do their own thing.
And when you talk about choosing games, is that choosing from a menu or just choosing from a blank page?
It's choosing, does this make sense? It's choosing from well-chosen resources. So practitioners who have that good understanding of children's learning and that really good understanding of play will already have chosen materials. Some of those materials and resources will be open-ended, and some of those materials will be quite structured. And so children will be choosing from a repertoire of activities within the environment. But I think also the best play comes when children can combine resources. So, for example, they might take the small world play into the construction area so they can build a village, a town, a spaceship, and then they can create stories using the figures and creating narratives about what those little small world figures do. Children also like to take things from the indoors to the outdoors so that they can experience using materials in different settings. So although some materials might seem quite structured, children will also use them in open-ended ways. A nice example of this is that I often see children taking counting materials from the maths area into the role play area, because things like beads and counters make very good things to put in the pans to make a stew, to pour into cups to make a cappuccino, or even to hide in different containers and shake and rattle them about.
So you've mentioned beans and counters. What other kinds of materials do you like to see in an area where children are at play?
We know from research that open-ended materials are particularly inspiring for children.
And what do you mean by open-ended materials?
Open-ended materials can actually be very cheap, everyday materials. Lengths of fabric, planks of wood, blocks of offcuts of wood, lengths of plastic tubing, plastic piping, the things that you might be able to pick up in a DIY store, or the things that parents often have lying around in a garage or an attic. So as long as those materials are safe for children to use, particularly rich play can come from combining and using those open-ended materials, because children can make something new every single day.
So it just doesn't have to be a set of commercial, colourful, expensive blocks, for example, or materials?
Absolutely not. In fact, research shows us that children's play is often extended in complexity when they have the freedom to combine materials in open-ended ways. Structured blocks and structured shapes, geometric shapes, have their place because they're really important for children to explore and to discover different shapes, how they fit together, how they can build with them. So again, we're getting back to this idea of structure and flexibility.
So how then, if there is this kind of, on the one hand, structure and flexibility, and on the other hand, this kind of open-ended nature to the materials, how does a teacher or an early years educator plan a programme of play? Or is that a contradiction in terms?
No, it's a good question, Sean, because it's actually not a contradiction in terms. Because in order for children to have that freedom, they do need some structure within that within which that freedom can take place. So This is partly what makes working with young children very challenging and very complex. And I think it is every bit as challenging to work with 2, 3, 4, and 5 year olds as it is to work with those students who are getting ready for their school leaving certificate, doing their advanced levels, getting ready for university. It is differently complex. So the role of the teacher is to provide this structured but flexible learning environment. Within that environment, the adult, the practitioner, will be sometimes observing the children, listening to what they're doing, listening to their thinking, so that they can use that knowledge and understanding to make sure that they can challenge children's thinking, they can add resources, they can make suggestions. So the role of observation is so important because that's where practitioners understand children's learning pathways, or another way of seeing it is their trajectories. So we know that all children learn in different ways and they learn at different rates. So observation is fundamental to understanding those learning and developmental pathways. From observation, we can have discussions about what the children are doing. What are they choosing? Who are they choosing to be with? Is a child repeating the same thing over and over again? And if so, what can practitioners do about it? Can they offer new materials? Can they offer suggestions? Can they have some small group teacher-directed activities where they're actually teaching some new skills or engaging children in new ideas to develop their interests? So from observation, we move to thinking and reflecting. We move to interacting with children in informed ways, and then stepping back to think about what are the next areas of provision? What are the next activities that we can be planning and developing? Sometimes with the children, sometimes through talking to parents and family members, and sometimes through talking with other practitioners.
So if I push this a little bit further, if you were planning to do some work with children, say, over a period of time, over a semester, say, what would your notes be like?
What would my notes be like? When I was a teacher in a primary school, I was head of a nursery department. My head teacher used to say that my weekly notebook was like a PhD. My notes would be fairly short. They would be like memos. They would be clear and easy to share with my colleagues. My notes would focus on what I'm seeing a child doing. So, for example, if I see a child who is standing back, not getting involved, maybe observing what is happening in a play activity, but just not getting involved with either with children or with activities, I would be asking myself questions about what's happening with that child. How can I help that child to engage with an activity? How can I find out what that child's interests are? So my notes perhaps would be to talk to the parent, talk to the childminder, talk to the family member who comes to pick the child up. Find out what the child does at home. Are there differences between what the child's doing at school in the preschool and what the child's doing at home? If I was working in a small group activity with a group of children and we were doing something that was focused on shapes or on counting, I would want to see whether children were beginning to use the correct terminology for different shapes, circle, square, rectangle. Are they able to use number words for counting and for ordering? And then I would make notes as to which child or which group of children need a little bit more stimulation to get the concept, to get the idea, or which group of children needs some challenge and extension because they're running with ideas of shape and number and space and measure.
To what extent is play children's territory, or to what extent can adults get involved? I'm thinking of the story of the selfish giant by Oscar Wilde, where the giant gets involved in the children's play. But to what extent should it be hands-off, or can adults actually interfere with what children are doing?
We were talking about this the other day, Sean, and I think there are three words. Interfering, involving, and interacting. Interfering is not what we want to do. And I know I could give you examples from my own practice, and certainly the practitioners I was working with on Monday all had those very embarrassing moments when they had interfered with children's play, they'd stopped the play, and the children clearly just want you to go away. I think over the years I have learned to interpret children's body language to show that they do not want an adult anywhere near their play. The involving, I think, is waiting for those important cues and signals from children that they do want you to be in their play. Then we go to the idea of interacting with children in their play. And I think the real skill lies in going with the flow of the play. Sometimes when you see a practitioner or even a parent inside children's play, they use that opportunity to do some teaching. So, for example, if children are making a picnic, they might say, and how many people are coming for the picnic? And how many cups do we need? Shall we lay out the knives and forks? That is not what you're doing, because you don't know who's coming to the picnic. It might be a giant. It might be some monsters. It might be some witches and fairies. And you might not be having sandwiches. You might be eating toads and frogs and all sorts of things that the children have conjured from their imaginations. So interfering is a no-no. Becoming involved is okay as long as it's on the children's terms. Interacting is fine as long as you are going with the flow of children's ideas and the roles that they assign to you. Whilst you're interacting in the play, you can be noticing things about children's language, their imagination, their creativity, their thinking. Then you can use that knowledge to then plan some experiences, again, to enrich, to extend, and to challenge. So you may be thinking pedagogically, but you should be interacting playfully.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with Sean Delaney. My guest this week is Professor Elizabeth Wood from the University of Sheffield. And she was in Ireland as a guest of the NCCA. They had a conference on Monday last on developing mathematics in the early years. Elizabeth, if we move on next to the area of mathematics, how early in their lives have young children been found to demonstrate mathematical awareness?
On Monday, I think we were all very privileged to hear Professor Doug Clements. He has done a lifetime of work on understanding children's thinking and children's mathematical development. And I think what one of the many very powerful messages that he gave us on Monday was that we can identify children's mathematical thinking from the very earliest months and the very earliest years of their lives. We don't have to wait for children to be competent with numbers to identify mathematics. So Doug talked to us about the importance of children's mark making, children's everyday activities as the sources for their mathematical knowledge. So talking about shapes, talking about size, noticing things in the environment, having building materials that they can organise around shape, talking about how many, how full, how high, how small, how big. So Professor Clements talked with us about the importance of mathematical language and using that language with children to help to develop their mathematical concepts. So that can be happening from the moment we start interacting with children and children start noticing what and who is in their environment. And then, of course, the important work that Professor Clements has done with his team is showing how those emerging ways of understanding mathematics then progress towards the more formal symbol systems that we perhaps understand more as schooled mathematical practices. So he gave some lovely examples of how working with children around mathematical problems is useful for showing us their mathematical thinking. And in that mathematical thinking, they can show us their errors, they can show us their misconceptions, and they give us the clues to the teaching points that we then take forward with the children.
And how early can an educator present mathematical problems to young children?
I think we can be, this comes back to your earlier question about interfering in involving and interacting with children in their play. So a good example might be engaging with children in their sand and water play. We know that children love to be filling containers and emptying them and pouring water and filling buckets and using egg cups to fill a jar or using a jar to fill buckets. But that's all well and good. Children are exploring materials, they're finding out what happens, but they don't learn important mathematical concepts unless we are using words like full, empty, half empty, floating and sinking, large and small, floating on the top, sinking to the bottom. So the interacting comes, the mathematical interactions are centred around using mathematical language and then listening to the way that children pick up that language and use it in their own activities.
When I was a student teacher in college, we learned about Piaget's stages. And, you know, they described how children moved through different stages of development and skills they acquire at various ages, like conservation of number and mass and so on. Where does our understanding of such stages stand today?
Piaget did some very important and highly influential foundational work on the nature of children's cognition. And I think what has been very exciting through my career is the way in which Piaget's work has been developed and extended and built on by other theorists, but also there have been some important challenges to the idea of stages of development. And some of those challenges come from the fact that we live in very culturally diverse societies. We have to be very careful about saying that there are universal stages of development when we know that children's learning is so powerfully influenced by their social contexts, by their home and family cultures, by the experiences that they have in their preschools, their homes and their community settings. So I like to work with the idea of trajectories of learning, that sometimes children run ahead in one area, but they might be a little bit slower in another area. And we have to be really tuned in to children's trajectories so that we don't make assumptions that all children should be moving through prescribed content in similar ways and at similar rates.
So when you're thinking about those trajectories, are you thinking about a mathematical trajectory, say a language trajectory, or is it more fine-grained than that?
There are many different trajectories. We can even think about a trajectory of play and playfulness. So yes, there are mathematical trajectories, language and literacy, geographical, and the arts and humanities. Children are constantly engaging with the tools for thinking and learning that we have that help us to make sense of the world. And I think inevitably we all have our preferences and we all have our interests, but that is also why children should have access to a broad and balanced curriculum so that they're getting enrichment in all of the areas. I guess perhaps a good way of thinking about this is I always loved history, the English language, English literature, poetry. I still love poetry and reading. Mathematics was a bit of a weak area with me. So I was very happy to do my reading and my writing and my poetry. And the maths I tended to shy away from because it involved so much more effort in my thinking and learning. But I had a very good teacher and she really helped me to get over some of that resistance and some of that confusion around mathematics.
And finally, Elizabeth, you've been working with educators in Ireland for the last few days and obviously for a long time prior to that. But after this particular visit, if there was one thing you wanted people to remember after your visit here, what would that be?
I think I would want to say to people, let's just step back from some of the assumptions that we make about play and draw on the research to show us what it is about play that links play with learning and how we can use those ideas to really think about high quality provision and practice with young children.
And that brings us to the end of this week's programme. I'd like to thank my guest, Professor Elizabeth Wood. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to almost 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.